It's Politics Day on the Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The sniping continues, and Iowa's race for governor will do some fact-checking on the latest claims. Will the debate over gay marriage pick up some traction as the race continues? In Washington, the renewal of unemployment benefits is still stalled in Congress, although federal financial reform may be a reality by the end of the week. Also, the energy bill has been resurrected. Has the Gulf oil spill given that legislation some momentum? We'll be talking about those topics and more in the next hour with our guests Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst, Todd Dorman of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and Diane Bystrom, the director of the Katz Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. We'd also like to hear from you with your comments and questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. First, this news. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is Politics Day on Talk of Iowa. A billboard comparing President Obama to Hitler is causing some controversy in northern Iowa right now. Numbers released yesterday seem to take some wind out of the sails of the Branstad campaign's claims that Chet Culver has grown state government in a time of recession. We'll do a little bit of fact-checking. Also, the debate over gay marriage. How key will that be in the governor's race? In Washington, the renewal of unemployment benefits is still stalled in Congress, although federal financial reform may be a reality by the end of the week. Also, the energy bill has been resurrected, and a new book has thrown the divide between rich and poor into stark relief. We'll be talking about these topics and more in the next hour, and we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me today is Diane Bystrom, the director of the Katz Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State. Hello, Diane.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. We also have Todd Dorman with us on the line. He's a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Hello, Todd.
Hi.
And, of course, Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. Hello, Arnie.
Hey, how are you?
Very good today. Well, let's start with talking about this billboard, which seems to be getting a lot of attention right now. Todd, do you want to kick us off? The billboard, it compares Obama to Hitler, and it seems to have caused a little bit of controversy even within the Tea Party.
Well, it's another instance of sort of the hyperbole that we live with watching politics these days. It's pretty amazing that this sort of thing rates, 600 words on the Associated Press wire, but I guess that wherever there's a controversy and wherever you throw Hitler into it, I suppose that's appropriate. But, the idea that there's actually a real debate out there that, is President Obama Hitler is ridiculous. And frankly, it's almost psychosis masquerading as politics.
Well, honestly, I almost didn't bring it up today, but it does seem to be getting a lot of attention right now. Diane, what's your take on this?
Well, again, I think like Todd said, I think it gets covered because not so much that it's representative of what, a large number of Iowans probably think, but the fact that it's very controversial, it's very visual. And I think the fact that, again, that it compares our president to Hitler is one. I mean, and when I Googled it yesterday, it was already in the London papers. And so it's getting news not only around the country, but around the world.
Well, but it's not a new thing, Arnie.
But doesn't it also, in a frightening way, it also speaks to their ignorance. Here they are so afraid about our naivete and our fear, and yet if you look at the billboard, you're going, wait a minute, you got a fascist and you got a socialist up there, and you have them somehow being the same. It speaks to their embrace of fear and their embrace of ignorance and the level to which the discourse has totally plummeted. And I think that's what, you can be angry at Barack Obama about his policy, but look what you do. You throw everything at him and hope something will stick. And that's what politics has turned into in this country. And unfortunately, this is more a celebration of our ignorance than it is a celebration of our discourse.
So the question is, should they be forced to take it down?
Oh, no. I think it's wonderful. I think they should replicate it everywhere. I think in some ways, the more you threaten them by taking it down, the more you draw attention to it. This is America. America means you have free speech. Free speech to be wrong. They are very wrong. We can celebrate their wrongness, but you don't suggest that they take it down. That's their mistake. They should embrace it.
Well, let's move on then to yesterday. We had some numbers out that kind of take the wind out of the sails of the Branstad campaign's claim that Culver has grown state government in his time there. And, you know, honestly, this seems like a lot of nitpicking going on. Do you think that this is an argument that is really speaking to the voters, Todd?
Yeah, well, I think voters are, you know, concerned about the state of the budget. But yeah, there is a lot of nitpicking going on. I mean, you've got the constant sort of exchange of barrage of fire between Culver and Branstad. You know, Culver attacking Branstad's budget record over his 16 years, and Branstad attacking Culver. I mean, I think probably the bigger picture is that neither of these candidates are really explaining to us going forward how they would change the way state government operates, or how they would build a budget differently than we have in the past, when we've sort of seen these binge and purge cycles where you have high spending increases and tax cuts when times are good, and then when times are bad, lots of across-the-board cuts which get passed on to local governments in the form of property taxes. Neither of these candidates has explained to us exactly how they would go forward, how they would do things differently. I mean, Terry Branstad has said that he would cut the cost of state government by 15%, but he has yet to really outline a serious plan for doing that.
Diane, I know you've been watching the ads very closely. Are there any arguments that you think are hitting home with voters?
Well, I agree with Todd right now. It's going on. I really think that these, you know, you've got the ads, and basically each side accusing each other of growing state government. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, I think that even with these new numbers, voters are going to get lost in the arithmetic. And so if you like Branstad, you're going to believe his commercials. If you like Culver, you're going to believe his. And so I think they're just kind of, again, right now getting lost in the arithmetic. And like Todd said, no really clear-cut ideas on how they're going to do anything different. You know, I've been here since 1996, so I've lived through the ups and downs of budget cuts in both the Branstad as well as the Vilsack and Culver administrations, and these numbers do include higher education. And there have been a lot of cuts to higher education. Well, do we celebrate that or not? You know, do we celebrate all of these cuts in state government? Because there's also been a reduction in state services. And as Todd says, there's been a passing of, you know, Iowans like their state services as well. And there was a recent poll about, I think, 6 months ago in the Des Moines Register that said that Iowans really would rather have a tax cut or tax raise in taxes and keep their services rather than all these cuts.
And I think the other thing you can do is that Iowa's not alone. And I don't know on which side of the aisle, but if I were the current governor and I were Chet Culver, I would basically go around the country and show exactly what the picture looks under Republican governors, under Democratic governors in the East, in the West, in the South, and say, wait a minute, welcome to our world. You know, this is the world of a boom-bust economy, and what is really remarkable, especially in a downtime, when more people need services because they depend on government, because government is filling in the gap when you're unemployed, government is filling the gap when you're sick, it turns out he was able to reduce the number. So I think you're absolutely right. We get become a blur, but maybe one of the things to do is to see how the rest of the country is doing and saying, so Iowa is not unique here. And at the same time, this is the nature of the economy. And if you need services, you need someone to deliver it. You know, no ticky, no surety. Let's be honest here. And that's really what the result is.
Well, you know, Branstad left office in good times. Culver has served in bad times. But it seems like voters don't really take that into account. It seems like with the anti-incumbent fervor across the nation right now that a lot of people in office are going to have to pay for the fact that they are serving during a recession.
Well, I don't really think the anti-incumbency thing is really going to play as much in this race as it does in others because, you know, you can't, you know, Culver's running against a guy that was governor for 16 years. And so I don't really think that – I think that's why this race has gone in different directions. I don't think that right now Branstad couldn't play on the anti-incumbency fervor that's sweeping the nation because in this race, I just don't think it's going to be a factor. I mean, you're comparing a current governor right now to a governor who was in office for 16 years. And so how can that be sort of an anti-incumbency argument?
And I think for Culver, it's less – his problem is less maybe with the big budget arguments and the fact that there's sort of been this drumbeat of 1,000 cuts where you've got a film tax credit that's spent on Mercedes Benzes and
yeah.
And you know and then you've got this latest thing where the alcoholic beverage division you know paid for a fancy dishwasher for its break room and thousands of dollars worth of art. There were just all sorts of smaller stories like that throughout his 4 years as governor that have sort of added up to this idea among voters that he's not overseeing the spending of their money properly. And I think that's a big issue for people. You know, if they pay taxes and the services are good and it's spent wisely, they don't mind as much as when they feel like it's being wasted or thrown away on frivolous stuff.
So what you're saying is that they're going to evaluate him on personal competence, not what's happening to the economy generically. And I think that's really the test for him. So, of course, it's not incumbency. It's, you know, we had a competent governor a couple years back. We have a less competent governor now. Now is the time when you need competence. And that would be the line I would play, not the size of government, because I don't think they get you anywhere.
We have Kim on the line in Des Moines. Hello, Kim.
Yes, good morning. Very interesting show, as usual. I just wanted to make a comment about same-sex marriage.
Okay.
The people who want to vote on this, they need to understand one thing very clearly. In a democracy, you do not allow a majority to vote on the rights of a minority. In 1837, the territorial Supreme Court of Iowa ruled that an escaped slave on Iowa soil was a free person. In the 1870s, the Iowa Supreme Court ruled against racial discrimination in accommodations and so forth. What would have happened had we allowed the public to vote on those measures? I think it probably would have been a negative result. I think it would have set back the cause of civil rights in this state for decades. So I think that we need to realize that. I think we need to have more democratic politicians who are willing to say that, you know, no, you don't have a right to vote on this, nor do I. None of us do.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And, of course, the point that Kim is making, former Governor Branstad is saying that if he does take office again, he believes he'll have the power to actually force a statewide referendum on same-sex marriage. And many other states around the nation have allowed the majority to decide on the rights of a minority. Diane, do you want to respond to that?
Probably not at this point. I mean, I've been following it. I don't think it's a way to go either to have someone vote on, and I agree with the caller.
Okay, Arnie?
I think what's interesting is you were asking me a few minutes ago about whether they should take the sign down for the poster that the Tea Party protest, and I said, no, this is a free country, and that we celebrate people's right, to be wrong, to embrace their freedom. I think in also this country we embrace people's right to make a decision who they love and how they want to enter into that contract for love. And that doesn't mean that it's going to be something that applies to me. It doesn't mean something that I want to embrace. It doesn't mean it goes against or with my religious principles. But I think that there's this libertarian streak in America that we have to accept. It was part of our early principles. And part of being a libertarian is that you have to accept other people's way of living. And so I agree with the caller. I think Terry Branstad is barking up the wrong tree with this.
Well, we will continue that conversation in just a moment, and we'd also like to hear from you at 866-780-9100. We're talking with Arnie Arneson, a political analyst from New Hampshire, Todd Dorman, columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and Diane Bystrom, director of the Katt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. This is Politics Day on Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. You're listening to Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it is Politics Day today on Talk of Iowa. With me is Diane Bystrom, the director of the Katt Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State, Todd Dorman, a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. And I want to return to the subject of gay marriage or same-sex marriage for just a moment, Todd, because you wrote a column recently about Kim Reynolds, who State Senator Kim Reynolds, who is also Terry Branstad's running mate. And in a moment of candor, she made a comment that civil unions might be okay by her, and then the campaign took that back shortly thereafter.
Well, and it was interesting too, because she made that statement in an interview with Douglas Burns, who's a reporter for the Carroll Times. And it was funny, in January I interviewed Terry Branstad and I had a similar moment where he seemed to think that maybe civil unions might be okay in the future, but he still thought that the word marriage should be assigned to relationships between men and women. I mean, that's, you know, it's it's one of those issues that evolves, and I think for a lot of people, you know, your stand on it evolves. Mine did. I went through a civil unions phase, I guess, and now I support full marriage equity. But it seems like within the confines of Republican politics right now, you can't step out of the orthodoxy, especially in Iowa, especially with the Branstad campaign fearing that they may have Bob Vanderplaats running at them from the right as an independent. But I mean, here's a candidate who was out there without a net, Kim Reynolds, a lieutenant governor candidate, and actually, you know, trying to talk her way through an issue based on what she believes, and it had to be slapped down immediately because they don't want to rankle the right. It's unfortunate.
I keep hearing the word in a candid moment. Isn't that frightening? It's like you can that can no longer exist in politics. Everything has to be nuanced, vetted, lockstep. No one wants to know what you think. They just want to know what the party wants you to say. And I think that's the saddest commentary about what just happened to her, is that what she was saying is, this is something I'd be willing to consider, and think about why she was even willing to say that, because she wants to make sure that people are cared for when they go to a hospital. She wants to make sure that someone has health care if they get sick. Think about all the sort of social benefit, even to civil union, that you are not allowed to embrace, because after all, it's a bad thing. Well, that's the saddest commentary.
Well, and the same thing has happened now again to Terry Branstad. He told a reporter that once the economy returns to some health, that he might consider raising the gas tax, which hasn't been raised in Iowa for 20 years, to you know, shore up some of the infrastructure, the crumbling roads and bridges, which is a perfectly reasonable position to take. He's now being battered for saying that he might raise gas tax. I mean, you simply can't say what you think anymore. You have to get your talking points out and recite them over and over again.
Well, and it happens quite frequently that a candidate for whatever office will say something off the cuff and then come back and say, no, that is not what I meant. This is actually what I meant. Do people buy that? Do the voters buy that?
Oh, I don't think so. But I mean, I say it's terrible, but I'm in the media, and we share a lot of the blame. We play got you and take stuff that for the candidates say and run to the other campaign, and you know, that's the way the game's played. But it is, you know, it is too bad that things have become so rigid as far as the partisanship that we can't have real debates in the gray areas about issues that, you know, face the state. It's, you know, there's no room for it. It's all people trying to catch someone else slipping up and then rushing a TV ad to the airwaves.
And I think the problem is Terry Branstad has not been able to say this to the fundamentalist right, that we will agree on 90% of the issues, but on 10% of the issues we won't. And then the question is, are you prepared to support me for the 90%? Nobody, in the end, can imagine someone walking lockstep, perhaps except for the extreme right and the extreme left. And I think the rest of us want someone who's going to say, look, this is what I stand for. This is where I am. I'm not going to embrace everything. But when it comes to, for example, he doesn't believe in gay marriage. I personally disagree with him. But that's where he can say, I am drawing the line. That should be enough for the fundamentalist right. It is not. And I think that the rest of the voters have to make a decision. Is it enough for them? And probably it is.
Yeah, and I think what we need to think about here, too, I mean, we always, you know, in our political discourse, we tend to look at the extreme left and the extreme right. And, you know, most Iowans and most Americans are somewhere in the middle. And I agree totally with Arnie saying, and the fact that, you know, I want to see a nuanced candidate. I want to see candidates that look thoughtful on the issues. You know, I don't want to say that they've been caught off the cuff. You know, my guess is that Kim Reynolds meant what she said and then had to take it back. And to me, again, that's the sorry state of things. I agree totally with Arnie. I want to elect someone, you know, I hardly ever vote for someone that I agree with on all the issues, and I want someone to be honest and straight with me on what they believe rather than just spewing out talking points. And I think that's what our political discourse has become in this country, and quite frankly, it's not only frightening, but it's boring.
And I want a candidate to say just what you said.
Yeah.
Don't you want Terry Branstad, instead of, you know, reining in his lieutenant governor, instead of saying, no, take it back, I'll translate for you, I want him to turn to the religious right or to the fundamentalist right of the Republican Party and say, let's go through exactly what she said, and let's understand she said she was willing to consider this, and let's understand, but instead, it was almost like you genuflect to something as opposed to act like an adult and say, this is a moment of clarity, and this is where, you know, I may disagree with you, but I think this is where we agree. So let's focus on where we agree, and you can learn to live with the rest. I want an adult candidate, and we've lost the sense of being an adult when it comes to politics.
Marge is on the line from Windsor Heights. Hello, Marge.
Okay, good morning. All I want to say, and I don't really intend to get into a discussion, is my understanding in regard to same-sex marriage is that a priest or a minister can refuse to marry people that they don't feel fit their rules. So what's the point? It's silly. It's just a silly argument because they can go to a judge or a justice of the peace or whatever we have in Iowa, and it doesn't affect the churches and the religion at all. Thank
you very much for your call, Marge. And Marge brings up a good point in that, do you think that this is an issue that's going to really matter to voters when it's time to vote?
I think her point is that this is a celebration of religious freedom. A priest can say no. A rabbi can say no. A minister can say no. And that is perfectly fine. That is perfectly fine. That is a total acceptance of your religious values. It's not an acceptance, and it's an acceptance of mine that I can say yes. Isn't that the celebration of freedom?
But will the voters feel the same way? What do you think, Todd?
Well, I think for some voters, you know, it's going to be an important issue. For some voters, it may be the only issue. But for the vast majority of voters, and you know, still, despite, you know, how partisan things have become on the edges, you know, elections in Iowa, I think, are still won in the middle. And I think in the middle, it's the economy. It's, you know, jobs, it's fiscal, you know, the budget being balanced. I think the economic vibrancy of the state, I think that's where the election's going to be won or lost. Some people are going to care about this issue, and frankly, I think people should care about this issue. It is important. It's an important question of individual liberty, religious liberty, as Arnie said. But I think the issues where this election is going to turn are going to be more in the pocketbook.
Well, before we get to our break, Bill is on the line from Brazil, Iowa. Hello, Bill.
Yeah.
What would you like to talk about?
Actually, with the talk about taxes and adults, one thing I found striking is that in Minnesota, two of the Democrats who are running for the nomination, as well as the Republican, who I think has already gotten the nomination, are all saying they will raise taxes. You know, instead of the, oh, no, can't do that, it just, they're saying, no, it's got to be done.
So maybe they've grown up in Minnesota.
What's that?
So they've grown up in Minnesota.
Yeah.
They took a maturity pill.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for alerting us of that anomaly in politics around the nation. I want to turn to national politics after the break. We only have about a minute left, but I saw in the Des Moines Register this morning that Christy Vilsack is eyeing a run for Congress. And Diane, I know you've spent a lot of time looking at women in politics. What do you think about that?
Well, I think most people know that she toyed with the idea of running against Grassley this campaign cycle and decided against it. And of course, Roxanne Conlon was also interested and announced at the time. You know, the next election, I think, makes sense, I think, for a woman to run, because I think that Iowa will go from probably five congressional districts to four. So, you know, evidence shows us historically that women have a better chance of winning, first of all, if they're in an open race. And so one thing that the redistricting could bring about is that someone may decide not to run. So that's one thing that could happen. And even if that doesn't happen, I think it also could bring about the fact that you're going to have kind of upset the apple cart, and there's going to be maybe two incumbents running against each other, and, you know, all sorts of things could happen. So I've always thought that Christy would make a great political candidate. I think she's very bright. I think she has an affinity to politics, and I think that it kind of makes sense that she might look at that race.
All right. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Diane Bystrom, director of the Katz Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University, Todd Dorman, a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and Arnie Arneson, a political analyst based in New Hampshire. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it's Politics Day on Talk of Iowa. With me today, Arnie Arneson, political analyst based in New Hampshire, Todd Dorman, a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and Diane Bystrom, director of the Katz Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University. We would also love for you to join our conversation. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And I want to turn now to the federal scene. Looks like federal financial reform may actually get passed this week. It picked up a couple of key votes in the Senate yesterday, although Senator Charles Grassley is still undecided. Arnie, do you think this is going to get through this week?
Well, we've got the New England triplets that are going along with it. We have the two women from Maine and, of course, the remarkable Scott Brown, who turns to be the fulcrum on all these issues. I think it will go through. And I'm still a little confused why Grassley voted for it in the Senate and is now still sort of on the fence or, you know, equivocating back and forth about why he's not for this. This is clearly not a perfect bill. And I think that there is some, you know, real reason why people should be concerned that Goldman Sachs says it's okay.
Yeah.
That means right there I'm thinking, oh, is it really okay? Is this financial reform or financial deform? I think it will pass. I think Republicans know that in some ways this is the kind of financial reform bill that they could only have prayed for, and they could thank, in fact, Scott Brown for making sure that there are lots of loopholes in this bill, and it's something that Wall Street can live with. If they actually kill this bill, what will come next may be much worse. So I do think it's going to pass, and I think you can thank the New England Republicans for it.
Okay, so if it does pass, then is that going to be, A, a good thing for the nation, B, a good thing for the Obama administration? What do you think, Diane?
Well, I think obviously Obama's worked on this bill for a while as part of his economic stimulus package. I think it'd be a good thing for the Obama administration. I agree with Arnie. I do think it'll pass whether or not Grassley decides to vote for it. They did pick up the key vote yesterday of Scott Brown, and I think it's going to pass. It'll be interesting to see what Grassley decides to do.
Todd?
Well, politically it has benefits. I mean, the Democrats had to get something through. I mean, this is a major piece of the agenda of voters who went through the collapse of Wall Street. I mean, you know, want this to pass. The thing is, we really won't know what impact this is going to have, because now this is going to go from the legislative branch into the sort of dark recesses of the executive branch, where there's going to be rulemaking and battles over how this exactly is going to be enforced. And if Wall Street wants this to pass, one of the reasons is because now they're going to bring their lobbying to bear on that rules-making process and try to get their stamp on how this is actually, the mechanics of this is going to work. Because, I mean, the bill is sort of this shiny car that you roll off the lot, but inside there's a lot of stuff that it's difficult to understand how it all exactly works, but that's what's going to make it go.
Yeah, a number of people have commented on the thousands of pages in the bill.
And this is the real this will actually be the real test of the Barack Obama administration, because regulations matter. Mm-hmm. Because this is more like headlines. Even though it's 2,000 pages, it's still pretty much the headlines. And it really is then going to, as we're talking about it, it is going to go into the bowels of the executive branch. And how they determine the rules and the regulations are really going to make the difference. And we're going to see whether the consumer is protected or whether Wall Street is protected, because that's where it will actually make the difference.
There's a new book out called Fault Lines, How Hidden Fractures Still Threaten the World Economy, that has turned the heads of a number of economists. And Arnie, I know you wanted to weigh in on this. The author of the book writes that of every dollar of real income growth that was generated between 1976 and 2007, 58 cents went to the top 1% of households. So what are people saying about this?
They don't know. I mean, I don't think people realize what that number means. And I was reading a blog by Robert Reich the other day, and what Robert Reich pointed out was that in 1928, the top 1% controlled about 28 to 29% of the total wealth in this country. That figure actually dropped in the 70s to about 8 or 9% of the total wealth. Well, guess what? Today, we're back up to about 28% for the top 1%. And the problem with that is that I was just listening to the news at the bottom of the hour, and one of the things they were saying is that consumers now need to step in to drive this economic recovery, because the government isn't going to be able to bail you out. Well, consumers can't step in if the top 1% is controlling so much of the wealth, because consumers need that access to wealth and income in order to spend. And I want to remind everyone what Henry Ford did. Henry Ford built a car. And why did he build a car? He wanted to make sure that the car was affordable to his workers, because he knew if the top 1% were making a lot of money, they could buy a couple of expensive cars. But it was when his regular worker could buy the car that was rolling off that plant, that was the definition of success. So I think this is very chilling about how an economy can recover if the wealth hasn't actually been spread around in a more equitable manner where it was in the 70s but is no longer today.
Well, and at the same time, I know we spent a lot of time talking about this last week, but unemployment benefits, the extension of unemployment benefits, is still stalled in Congress. And what impact do you think that's having on spending, on driving the economy right now? And what do you think is going to happen with that situation? Arnie?
Well, what's ironic is that I was reading an article this morning about how the Republicans don't want the extension of unemployment. They think it's one Republican referred to it as a necessary evil that the unemployed, you know, continue to get benefits. But at the same time is calling it a necessary evil. They don't want to roll back the tax cuts on the very wealthy. See, that's a good, but extending benefits for the unemployed is a bad thing. And I think that that's problematic, because you know that every single dollar that is going to an unemployed worker, virtually all those dollars are being generated right back into the economy. They're paying their mortgage, they're paying their electric bill, they're paying their food bill, they're making the car payment. They're probably not even making those payments very well because they're dipping into savings as well. But you know those dollars are going back into the economy. I guess the question is are you cutting off your nose to spite your face by denying people unemployment at a time where, you know, you are not seeing businesses create jobs? My daughter was at a company that outsourced 220 jobs. They just opened up for new employment. 10 jobs are being opened up. 220 went to India. They've just said they will hire 10 people. Do you know how many people are applying for those 10 jobs? That's where I think that, you know, members of Congress are in la-la land when it comes to unemployment. They need to walk the unemployment line.
Well, do you think that there, with the longer this is delayed, Todd, do you see any movement among people in Iowa? Are people getting more and more upset? Is there going to be a backlash against Congress because of this stall?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who don't understand it. Probably primarily, I think there's 14,000 or so Iowans who lost benefits when the deadline passed, and there's thousands more who saw benefits reduced. I agree with Arnie. I mean, if there's one issue that shows that some of these folks in Congress are out of touch, it's that they're peddling this idea that, well, these people are unemployed because they really don't want to work. Well, I mean, that's really ridiculous for the vast majority of them. I mean, the jobs just are not being created. The economy is not creating them. And the people who have jobs are not seeing their wages increase. They're seeing the costs of health insurance and some of these things increase. Wages are stagnant for those who are still earning them. So, I mean, the picture out here is bleak, and there's a lot of worry about the slow steps toward recovery that we've taken are going to backslide. And I think that's a real worry. And I think this unemployment debate is all part of that.
I think it's really a personalization of the economic situation we're in. You know, I know of a lot of people, not only in Iowa, but nationally, like, you know, have a story like Arnie's, that they have either a family member or a friend or a colleague or someone who's been laid off of a job, the same type of thing where you lay off hundreds of people and open up two or three jobs. And so, you know, I think it's really a personalization of our economic times. And I think the personal is more provocative, I think, in this debate.
And it's not just the personal, but I'm the mother of two daughters who just recently graduated from college, and they're talking to all their friends. And let's talk about not just the unemployed, but the people who cannot get a job. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where they're playing their cards wrong, because they are more acutely aware of what the job market looks like because their 22-year-old has moved into the house, because their 24-year-old is moving back to the house. because all of a sudden these people with these gorgeous degrees are not finding the kind of employment opportunities. So it's not just the unemployed, it's those that can't bridge into employment. And so those numbers are really, I think, not honest when it comes to how difficult this economy is. So a lot more people are acutely aware of the challenges, even if a member of their family isn't unemployed. It's that new graduate who can't get employment.
Well, and Iowa is hurting, but compared to many other states in the nation, Iowa's in pretty good shape. So this pain that we're feeling in Iowa is a lot more acute in many other places. I want to turn now to another subject that has been stalled in Congress for some time, which is the energy bill. And Harry Reid just reintroduced an energy bill yesterday. Do you think that the oil spill in the Gulf is going to give the energy bill some more urgency at this point and maybe actually a little bit of momentum? Todd, what do you think on that?
Yeah, I think, obviously, the oil spill is a horrible thing, but with regard to this energy bill, I mean, it has revived it. I mean, it was pretty much dead for months, and now is back on the agenda. Will it pass? I mean, you know, can anything pass the Senate? I mean, that's sort of the question. I mean, if you don't have 60 votes, and it can't happen. And right now, I don't think they got 60 votes for this bill. But I think it's an issue that people care about. It's an issue that's in front of people now, and so I think the majority leader is smart to try to force something to happen.
Diane?
Yeah, I think it's kind of economic, or its time has kind of come in terms of political timing. When Obama first took office, he had a number, I think, of initiatives that he wanted to make progress on. Some people said that maybe he had too much on his plate, but certainly he had energy, you know, in that first mix. I think at the time was told kind of to back off on that and focus on the economy and health care. But I think right now it's an opportune time with the leak of oil in the Gulf. And so I think what they're doing now is that it may not pass, as Todd said, but this is a time maybe to kind of push the agenda now because of the political climate and the fact that we have a disaster going on.
And this is political theater. Let's remember that the BP oil spill is your backdrop, okay? Mm-hmm. Think of it as a stage. And now you have the BP oil spill as a backdrop. Everyone's trying to come up with some creative way of doing it. All of a sudden we're beginning to realize if we don't have money and we're facing an economic downturn and this oil is just completely doing destructive things to an entire coastline that we can't even envision what the cost will be. BP cannot pay for the long-term cost of this. There's no way that there's enough money on the planet to actually probably do that. I think the backdrop means that it's an opportunity to be a teachable moment. It is not about passage, but it's about reinforcing what the choices are, how difficult they are, and how we have to make them, not tomorrow, but yesterday.
The number to call is 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have a number of callers who want to return to the subject of same-sex marriage. John is on the line. Hello, John.
Yes.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, you know, one of your callers said that the majority must not rule, you know, the minority, and that all of human history, where government's concerned, it's the minority telling the majority how to live. I mean, you also mentioned that priests, you know, don't have to marry people that believe, but take a look at England when Henry VIII decided to go Protestant. He never had the support of more than 1% of the population. He wiped out the Catholic charities, which aided the poor and gave poor but bright boys a means of, you know, to get ahead in the world.
Right. Well, we're looking pretty far back for some precedents on this subject. John, do you think that the people of Iowa should take a vote? Should there be a referendum on gay marriage?
Sure. I mean, if you don't trust the people, there's two types of democracies. In one, the citizens are aristocrats. In one, there are serfs. If you're saying they shouldn't vote, you're saying this democracy, they're serfs.
All right. Well, John, thank you for your opinion today. We also have Rob on the line. He's on I-80 somewhere right now. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Charity. First of all, welcome back to Iowa. It's great to hear you back on Iowa Public Radio.
Thank you so much.
I just want to throw in a question to your panelists today. I was wondering if Todd or Diane has heard of a big out-of-state funded effort to recall the or vote in the retention election for the Iowa Supreme Court justices. I know on the Hill they're very worried about that, and I just wondered, I haven't read much about it or heard much about it, just kind of inside baseball, but I wonder if you've heard any of that.
All right, Diane, have you heard anything about it?
Just a little. I heard that there might be some efforts. I don't know about the funding and outside, but there might be some efforts to recall the judge that had the decision on the gay marriage issue.
How about Todd? Have you heard anything on that subject?
Well, I know that evangelical Republicans have been calling for their folks to vote against retaining the judges. I mean, it was a unanimous decision, so they'd like to pick off as many as possible. So I know that's out there, and I know it was an issue in the gubernatorial campaign, and actually Terry Branstad was the one candidate who sort of backed away from the idea that there should be a concerted campaign to remove them from the court. And maybe one of those reasons is that the judge who wrote the decision was appointed by Governor Branstad.
Yeah.
Can I make a point here that remember how money is fungible? Well, money in politics is really fungible. And what I mean is that it happens all over the country where groups come in and they fund a different grassroots movement. They fund these things. That's the whole problem with a lot of these recalls, is that, you know, people keep saying this is really a grassroots movement. It turns out it feels more like AstroTurf. And is there really a drumbeat in Iowa for this? Or are there groups agitating outside, influencing with their money and their causes to make a difference? And that's really what people have to be vigilant about. Is this about Iowa, or is this about somebody else trying to pull the strings? California is known for its referendum, and they will tell you that it's no longer been grassroots. It's now really artificial turf.
All right, Larry is on the line from Illinois. Hello, Larry.
Yes.
What would you like to talk about?
I've listened to this same-sex marriage debate for years, and this seems like such a no-brainer to me. Maybe I'm missing something, but if you ask, I'm straight, but my question is, if you ask someone who is opposed to the gay marriage issue, ask them why it is that they oppose it. What do they base that on? And it inevitably comes down that they have a moral issue with it. And I ask, okay, what's this moral based on? Everyone has to have something that they base their morals on. And 99% of the people say, well, God says it's wrong. It's a religious issue. And I can quote you verse and chapter that, yes, God does say homosexuality is a sin. However, we don't live in a theocracy. We live in a country that is ruled not by scriptures, but by a constitution. And our founding fathers were very wise in putting this piece in on the First Amendment that allows everyone to practice their religion as they choose so or not to. And the problem is once you allow a religious issue to dictate to the Constitution how that is to be wrote into law, you've now violated the First Amendment because you've established a state-recognized religion.
Well, Larry, thank you for that. What do you guys want to respond to that? Do you think that there's an argument there? Todd?
Well, I think I've heard that argument from proponents. I mean, I've never figured out why. I mean, I sort of think that same-sex marriage is actually a conservative principle. I mean, it's encouraging people to come together, to have stable families, family relationships recognized by law. I've never completely understood. I understand the religious objections, but I've never understood why conservatives are so vehemently against expanding a traditional American institution to more people. I don't get it.
The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I asked earlier if you thought the same-sex marriage debate was going to be a key issue for voters in November, and it's certainly gotten a lot of people talking on the air today. John is on the line from Quad Cities. Hello, John.
Yeah, hi. Ever since this same-sex marriage came up, I keep on thinking, basic sociological principles, the family is the basic building block of society. How does that compare with political and law? The two don't seem to get along. I'm just wondering what the experts are thinking.
Well, who would like to respond to that?
Oh, can I just say something? Yeah. One of the reasons why you have so many calls on this issue is that, for the one thing, marriage is the one thing that we're all going to probably have some sort of relationship with or contact with. We're not going to have a lot of relationship with maybe some of the aspects of the financial reform bill. We don't understand necessarily all the aspects of the energy bill, but marriage we get. Usually because we are in divorce court, or we're having children, or we're going to a wedding. And so I think it's the one thing we all feel that we can have an opinion on, because it's the one thing that actually touches 99% of us, you know. And so that's one of the things. And the other point that he was making is that he was basically saying the libertarian thing, which is, this is a family structure butt out. This is not for government to make the determination. This is for me to make the determination with the person I love, with the religious institution I believe in, with my set of values. And I think that that's a powerful thing to remember. And I also want to go back to one of your last callers. And that is, this country has always celebrated religious freedom, which is why we have more places of worship per person in the United States than any other country in the world. That's because we've tended to step away from embracing one particular set of religious principles, and we've allowed people to celebrate theirs.
Diane or Todd, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think Arnie summed it up great. I think what we're talking about here is a civil rights issue versus a religious issue. And I think we do have, you know, we have religious freedom in this country. I agree with Arnie that we need to celebrate that. I think the way that the Supreme Court decision in Iowa was structured, it was a civil rights issue. And so you're really looking at the view of civil rights, which is in libertarian civil rights, that, you know, that people have the right to form these unions. And I think the issue about the religious part of it varies by religion. And so I think it's two separate issues, and I think it both gives us some freedom.
All right, Diane, thank you so much. Diane Bystrom, the director of the Katz Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University, Todd Dorman, a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire-based political analyst. We'll be back with more politics next Wednesday on Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. We had production assistance today from Lindsay Moon, technical support from Michael Yeager in Ames. We always welcome your comments. Send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, it's Home Improvement Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.